Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Today's show is about tactics. How do we change minds, including our own, when we need to? Now, if you're like me and so many other people, you want to see the best ideas win. I mean, whatever the best idea is, let's just do that. Let's pursue that. And, instead of being out there in discussions with religious people and just banging our heads against the wall because we feel like they've shut down, they've closed off, they're not listening, you know, we're trying to break through. We're saying, please, just listen and hear what I'm saying and understand it and digest it and consider it. We're begging them, please, just open up a little bit and you might find that I have a point. And instead, we get frustrated because it's like a brick wall. You can't get through. How do we get the information digested and considered? How do we make a difference? How do we change minds? I mean, it doesn't happen very often, especially on the internet. We just end up shouting at each other. You know what? You're wrong. Oh, yeah? You're wrong. Your information is flawed. No, your information is flawed. You're an idiot. No, you're an idiot. I see it every day. I see it about every 5 minutes, especially on Twitter and Facebook. It's maddening. Like, we don't have trouble engaging people. I mean, we're not shy. It's not a problem of actually starting the conversation. It's the fact that we just often seem to never get anywhere. How do we change minds? And as we're human, and all of us are susceptible to having bad information or a bad idea or a bad opinion, how do we change our own minds when we get something wrong? It is a much-needed conversation. And that's what today's broadcast is. There's a video of what you're about to hear. So if you'd like to watch the interview, the YouTube link is in the description box of this podcast. I will introduce my 4 special guests in just a second. You know, I've become a student of how we evolve our thinking. You know, how we build this database of knowledge. How do we learn stuff? Well, there's a lecture series that ties right into this theme. It's called How We Learn. It's taught by Professor Monisha Pashupati. She got her doctorate at Stanford. She knows a lot about how we educate other people and ourselves. You can watch her whole series at The Great Courses Plus. It is rich with insights about learning, how the brain recognizes and learns stuff, why the brain sometimes shuts down and says, I will never get this, and what do we do about it? Why emotion's not always the enemy of learning. That's a surprise to a lot of folks. The myth that you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Why older people can learn new things and should. Using language and stories and enthusiasm and the best tools out there to learn new things. How We Learn is just a wonderful series at The Great Courses Plus. It is just one of over 8,500 lectures that you can stream or download to your TV, computer, laptop, smartphone, or listen to in podcast form on their app. Learn about learning right now. They are giving my listeners a free trial with unlimited access to all of their lectures, but you have to use my special URL. So start your free trial right now. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. On my panel today about tactics, how to change minds, including our own, I have Matt Dillahunty of Atheist Debates and the Atheist Experience, probably the most experienced debater of religious people that I can think of. He joins us for the panel. Coven Sinopathy, she's a science communicator and an author and a public speaker. Her work has been featured in Forbes and on NPR and elsewhere. She's co-author of the book, The Fear Babe, Shattering Bonnie Hari's Glass House. So she takes on the food babe pseudoscience. I've got Sarah Hayter, co-founder of Ex Muslims of North America. She's an activist and a speaker and a public voice for ex-Muslims and atheists, and she engages with believers worldwide. And Anthony Magnabosco, he runs the Street Epistemology website. This guy just goes out on the street all the time, like all the time, and just randomly engages religious people. And he gets it on camera, and he's got a whole YouTube page and website documenting these exchanges. He joins us for a conversation about changing minds. I want to start with a quote from Dr. House. Now, I haven't watched House, but I'm going to have to now that I'm going to hopefully meet him at the American Atheist National Convention coming up in just a few weeks. I'm very excited that he's the keynote, right? He's like a Renaissance man. He's a musician, a comedian, an actor, and he is also an atheist. He does not believe in gods. And House apparently is quoted, there's a meme going around that says, if you could reason with religious people, there would be no religious people. And I see it shared on a lot of atheist pages, and it makes me cringe a little bit because, you know, I it doesn't really resonate with me. But I don't know, you want to sound off? Anybody want to talk about this particular idea? How do you reason someone who is practicing unreason in the first place?
I'll jump in, even though I'm going in a slightly order, because there's a couple things I want to hit before the quote even. First of all, I'm shocked, Seth, that you haven't watched House. I mean, just go watch it.
Forgive me.
I've never seen it either, Seth.
Every episode start to finish twice. And there may be a sub discussion about how atheists are presented as characters on TV because it's problematic. But just for clarity, at the American Atheist Convention, Hugh Laurie, the actor who plays House, will be there. And I want to make sure that, you know, if we're quoting from House, that we don't suggest that even Hugh Laurie agrees with the quote, because House is pretty much an ass and very snarky and snide. And Hugh may think that that's a great quote, or he may be as opposed to it as I am, because I've always cringed and despised that quote, because it's very much the same thing as you can't reason someone out of something they weren't reasoned into, except that they were reasoned into it. Every belief that you have is the result of reasoning. It's just maybe the result of really bad reasoning, like arguments from authority, the indoctrination process. I don't know how to change anyone's mind about anything without using reason. Even if you just said, well, you could beat them until they change their mind. I'm not convinced you've changed their mind. You may. It's like holding a gun to somebody's head and saying, tell me you love Jesus or I'm going to shoot you. Okay, I'm going to say I love Jesus, but you didn't change my mind. I don't know how to do it without reason.
Well, I mean, did I come to that position automatically from a reasoning, or can it be just an assumption or, you know, something else at play? Did I automatically reason my way into a bad idea?
I don't think so. I would say no. Yeah, I'd be. Again, I guess I would disagree with Matt there. I do think that sometimes it has to do with bad reasoning, but sometimes it doesn't have to do with reasoning at all, especially if it comes early enough. There's a lot of things I've never reasoned myself into. I mean, I believe in gravity, you know, as a force, and I've believed in it that there's a thing called gravity in it when it worked in a specific way. I didn't know anything about it. And if you had asked me when I was seven, you know, what is this and how does it work, I wouldn't have been able to tell you anything because there was no reason there. I think there's a lot that we absorb from the world around us without knowing that we're absorbing it. And we assume it's reasonable, and we just like we assume everything that we pull in and we believe is moral. But I think that is an assumption more often than not. And sometimes good, effective, you know, ways of changing people's mind can be just pointing out that, hey, you really did pick it up without really maybe thinking about it all the way through. And, you know, here's some problems that you know, may have gone along that way.
I see Matt's leaning forward toward the microphone.
Well, I think she just described bad reasoning. This is when I say that there's no position you come to without reasoning, it may be, you know, a quick intuitive leap, but everything that you believe is the result of becoming convinced, and you can become convinced for good reasons or bad reasons. When you say, oh, I believed in gravity. Well, you actually had good reasons. The fact that you didn't consciously go through and construct a syllogistic argument doesn't mean that you weren't still reasoning. You can say, hey, I kind of intuited this or I absorbed it from around me. but there's still a reasoning process. Your brain goes through some heuristic model where it says, I'm convinced of this or I'm not.
Coven, did you want to jump in here?
I think there's this assumption that we have, whether or not the reasoning was explicit or not, that we as humans have positions on everything. And there are an infinite number of things to have positions on, right? So we don't reach our conclusions by reasons all the time. I mean, yes, reason, depending on how you define it, but there are totally values. I mean, we can talk semantics, but yes, there are value systems by which people arrive at certain conclusions. They're not every single topic. And I'm saying this as someone who argues in favors of vaccines, GMOs, et cetera, with reason. But still, there are value systems and other kind of snap kind of not explicit ways to think about things that cause us to arrive at certain worldviews or conclusions. And I think probably as Anthony might tell you, like, as much as you reason with someone, people are just like, nope, I just feel this way. I mean, just getting down to like the basics of how humans work, sometimes you just feel a way. And I don't think that any of us have been immune to that. And I'm sure if we reach down into the depths of who we are, we each maybe have one pet belief that might not be, we might not be able to be reasoned out of.
Anthony Magdabosco, what are your thoughts, my friend?
Man, I've had more than 1,000 conversations with people. And one thing, the biggest takeaway I'd say is that most people really don't think about their beliefs. Kind of what I think Sarah was getting at the start. They very rarely slow down to say, how did that belief get in my brain? And just the act of asking a person, why do you think that? How did you conclude that it's true? Can in itself be the start of an exploration of figuring out how that belief got in there and do I have good reasons for it? So just the fact that you might be asking somebody a question to justify a belief that they've held for the longest time could actually start them on a journey of possibly abandoning a belief if they don't have a good reason for it.
So I guess you haven't even reasoned them out of their belief with your work. It's just you work them through whether or not they reasoned into it in the first place.
I like to look at it as giving a person the tools to investigate their belief on their own. I don't want to reason anyone out of anything. I want them to reflect on their, I want to create an environment where they're reflecting on their belief, but I want them to want that themselves. You know, I would love it if people believe true things. And if they want to believe true things, they might learn the tools in order to question their beliefs and then decide, do I need to keep this belief? Do I need to find better reasons to hold the belief? Or do I maintain the belief?
I mean, my knee jerk here is, hell yeah, I want to reason people out of unreasonable ideas. Like I want to be about reason and reasoning the processes of how we come to accept and embrace and divide, you know, the wheat from the chaff, so to speak, how we separate the bad ideas from the good. So, I mean, I think reason is involved. Reasoning is involved at all levels, is it not?
Well, I think so. But my position is that people need to be able to examine these beliefs on their own. Sure, I can probably provide somebody with the facts that contradict a view that they have. And one thing that seems to be clear, although it might be debatable, is that presenting somebody with facts that challenges their position, especially if it's something that's tied to their identity, might cause them to want to hold on to that belief and dismiss your facts. So I love this approach of the street epistemology or the Socratic approach of asking a person a question for them to discover that, oh man, maybe I didn't reason myself into this belief. Maybe I used a bad process, a bad methodology for coming to this conclusion.
Well, without rehashing and worrying about the semantics of, you know, oh, is everybody reasoned in everything? I don't know how anybody can have a position that isn't the result of thinking, good thinking or bad thinking, and that's reasoning. But the issue here with the quote is that you can't reason somebody out of, or the actual quote from the episode of House is that if you could reason with religious people, there would be no religious people. I don't know how else to change someone's mind other than to engage in this process of reasoning. And more importantly, the quote is fundamentally false. If you couldn't reason with religious people, I would still be religious today, as would the thousands of people who've changed their mind as a result of debates and shows and, you know, all these other things. It is a cynical statement. It is not a reasonable, skeptical statement. It is, in some sense, it is more divisive than almost anything that I've heard, which is, oh, there's those of us who, you know, we can be reasoned with, but religious people can't. And it may be the case that there are some religious people who will ever be immune to good arguments and evidence, but that you can't say that for all religious people. That's just obviously false.
If we go we're talking just about definitions. And if me as a child thinking my mother knows best and my mother believes in God, so I believe in God. If that's a form of reasoning, if that's how we're defining it, sure. That's reasoning. And that's a potentially bad reasoning. Not necessarily. It's right in a lot of ways, right? Your mother is right about a lot of things. So I don't know if that's necessarily bad reasoning in that context. But to go back to what other people were saying I think, Coven, you were talking about that. Some people just can't be reasoned out of certain things. And when you talk to them about it, they'll say, well, they just feel something to be true. And that's the end of that. I do think it's important to look at a person's motivations. I think there are many, you know, religious people in particular who will tell you, well, my motivations are to be reasonable. And actually, I think I'm being very logical here. And in that scenario, then walking them through, you know, the logical contradictions or what may or may not be true is a good idea and is a good way to approach it. But I do think it's important when we're looking at, you know, whether someone can be convinced in a particular way to see why they are motivated to believe what they are motivated to believe. And there are some people who find some emotional benefit out of something, and that's what they're getting out of it. And that's their primary motivator. And in that scenario, you will have to target that emotional benefit and talk about that and what they're getting and why they believe that they're getting something like that out of it.
Yeah. The one thing we've seen over and over again is you can have a conversation with someone and drill down until you have very clearly identified the foundational flaw that serves as undergirds what they believe. And yet they still won't accept that that's a flaw. We do know, you know, that happens all the time.
Well, Sarah's anecdote of her mother, or maybe a hypothetical mother, I'm not sure what you meant, Sarah, reminded me of my childhood, because around the age that my kids are right now, I started having questions of mortality and spirituality. And I was raised pretty staunchly atheist. So I remember asking my dad, well, you know, how do you know that there's no heaven? Or how do you know that there's no reincarnation? I just had all these questions. And he goes, well, because I just know, you know, life is a biochemical reaction and the end of life is the end of life. I'm like, well, how do you know that? And he didn't have an answer. And I was just this funny kid. And my kids have the same questions now, and I don't answer them the same way that my dad answered me. But still, I'm just like, it's the most likely thing. that's how you explain it to a 4-year-old, I guess.
Does data matter in these conversations? You know, I mean, when I first got into atheist activism, I remember walking into battle thinking, I have such good information. You know, I brought with me all these great minds, you know, the books and the resources and the TED Talks and the YouTube links and the lectures and the wonderful educational resources, thinking once my religious family and friends see this, they'll overwhelmingly, you know, drop all the superstitious nonsense and they will embrace better ideas. Of course, that's how naive I was. Nothing of the kind remotely happened. Like, they just doubled down. The walls went up, the arms went out, you know. And I remember walking away thinking, you know, if they're not listening to information, what's the way in? Or maybe that's not even the right question to ask. Anyone want to speak to that?
I can. I'd like to speak to that, actually. I think the venue is a huge factor here. Like, for example, Seth, I'm somewhat familiar with your story. I think you started stumbling across videos and watching them, and they were probably giving those counter-apologetic arguments in those videos that helped you reflect on your belief. But in a sort of a one-on-one situation or having a conversation with a family member, that just might not be the best approach. So I think you have to consider who am I dealing with here? Am I having a one-on-one conversation? Am I in a debate? Am I observing a video? These are all factors that I think we have to keep in mind when deciding, do I need to present counter-apologetics, or would it be more beneficial to ask some gentle questions to challenge the foundation of a person's belief?
Peter Boghossian, who wrote A Manual for Creating Atheists, he and I were speaking, and he was talking about how people change their minds from a position of safety, meaning if they feel attacked, they're much less inclined to make that change. And so if I'm watching Christopher Hitchens, who's just destroying religion, but I'm watching without him coming after me personally, it's more of a forensic examination of the argument. But if, you know, Christopher Hitchens and I were having coffee and he said all that those things, I might feel personally attacked.
That's the big disconnect that I think most atheists fall for. They watch these great debates, these great arguments between atheists and believers, for example, and they think that's the approach I'm going to use with my mom on the next Thanksgiving. Probably not the best approach. However, if you do use that with your mom, you might have siblings watching that might be convinced by observing the exchange if they're not that, if they're not the target of your aggressive approach. So again, I think venue is important. You also have to assess your goals. What am I trying to accomplish here? Do I want to defend atheism? If so, I think the counter-apologetic approach is great. Like I've become so much better at defending my atheism after watching years of Mr. Dillahunty here on The Atheist Experience and others presenting the counter-apologetics. That's been great. But I would definitely rethink my approach if I was going to sit down with my mom, for example.
That's how we all refer to Matt. We call him Mr. Dillahunty. You
know, yes, let's never do that.
Good to know. I feel like you should have warned me ahead of time. I don't know if I was disrespectful earlier. If so, no, I apologize. No.
Anybody else want to weigh in on data points and how minds are changed?
I would like to add, I mean, I come from this. I do a lot of work in the space of critiquing widely held beliefs when it comes to food and health and biotech and parenting, as I mentioned earlier. And there are a lot of parallels with what Anthony touched on. It kind of depends on the venue and your goals. So if you're arguing with kind of the leader of any given movement, whether it's an anti-GMO movement or an extremist religious movement or an anti-vaccine movement, your goal isn't always to sway the person that you're arguing with, right? Your goal is to reach the people sitting there quietly, kind of watching, who may be on the fence. So it's just fascinating to me, although I am an atheist or an agnostic, I don't often talk about these issues, but the communication and the kind of just tactics are so similar.
It's one of the things that's been, I've hosted the show for 14 years and we've seen a lot. I'm not usually trying to change the mind of the person I'm talking to. That's not completely true. I'm presenting the best case for my position and the best rebuttals that I can come up with against their position. And I'm presenting what I think should, if people were, you know, being fair and reasonable, should change their mind, the person I'm talking to. But I don't see that as a primary goal. I want to have an audience because I know from countless people who've emailed that someone will be sitting there watching the show. And the person I'm speaking to, my interlocutor, will have a position that's identical to theirs, and they will present the argument that the person sitting at home would have presented. And the person sitting at home doesn't suffer the embarrassment of being exposed. We know that once somebody's made a public profession of a belief, they're less likely to change their mind. So the audience is sitting in this safe zone going, wow, now I can actually think about this, and maybe that person in the audience is likely to change their mind just so they don't have to go through the embarrassment of presenting, you know, an awful argument. Somebody presented an awful argument against flat earthers today on Facebook, and I ripped it to shreds. I feel bad because the argument was so bad, it looked like flat earthers made it just so they could rebut it. But the people are so generally ignorant about science that it was like, oh, here's another anti-flat earther argument. I'm just going to spew it out on Facebook when it was garbage. And so I think if you have this goal of caring about the truth, which is something that I frequently have to ask people, okay, do you actually care what's true? Because if you don't, there's not much point in us having a conversation. But if you do, then we should be able to get to a point where we both have expressed how we would go about discovering the truth in this situation. And at least one of us is wrong if we disagree. Perhaps we're both wrong.
I know Matt's done a whole lot of debate. Mr. Dillahunty has done a whole lot of debating. Sarah Hayter, did I see that a video of you, were you in a debate against a religious person, or was I taking that out of context? Maybe it was a speech.
Yeah, I haven't yet done a public debate yet, so it probably wasn't me. And I think part of it has been because of what other people have said, which is that I don't know about convincing other people right then and there, but perhaps the real value of debates is just the people that are watching. I think sometimes speeches can do a good job too. Well,
what's your angle, Sarah, when you speak to people one-on-one? I mean, how do you jump into that? Do you assess them first and then decide what tack to take? What's your...
Well, it's interesting because I agree with what Matt was saying with approaching them, and that, okay, well, I guess here's how I would differentiate, because I think what Matt said was, if you are a reasonable person, then you would think this, and then you would want to approach in this way. I go ahead and make that assumption. I say, hey, we're both reasonable people here. So given that we're both reasonable people, we can talk about it in such and such a way. And I think that changes the conversation a little bit. I amplify the commonalities that we have and try to remove the ego aspect of it as much as possible. Although, in a one-on-one conversation, that may not be possible. I think it is really, really difficult to do. And so what works for me has been to encourage them to look into things on their own and to ask questions. And I'll ask questions in a way that, well, you know, maybe you can change my mind. Here's what I'll need to change my mind. And if you can find such information, then, you know, I'm happy to hear it. And then they'll go look off on their own. And then they do that passive mind-changing process that I think just works. It works better.
You know, I hear a lot from people in the atheist movement, or movements in atheist circles. Well, we need our firebrands and we need our diplomats. And I'm not really sure where the lines are drawn, what exactly is a firebrand or a diplomat. But, you know, we need the asshole, and then we need the counselor friend over here, and then everybody in the middle, everybody who runs the spectrum. Does anybody want to speak about firebrands, diplomats, the concepts being thrown out about, you know, we need the edgy people to push the buttons and stir the pot, and we also need those who can go and sort of heal and hold and sort of handhold everybody to better ideas?
I can speak to that a little bit. So, yeah, I think these terms are a little murky, and every time it comes up in a conversation, it tends to get murkier. The current definition that I prefer at this point is what Silverman has come up with, that if you give a shit, if you care, and you want to speak up, whether you use a soft approach or you are very aggressive, you are being a firebrand. Silverman has classified street epistemology as firebrand because you're not just nodding your head and smiling and letting somebody pray for you, but you might say, hey, do you mind if we chat about why you think prayer works? And I think that might be that's the kind of definition that I prefer, is that if you're a firebrand, you're willing to do something. You're willing to speak up. Whether you go 10 miles an hour or 100 miles an hour, that's fine. But I think that would probably be classified as firebrand in my
mind. When I hear firebrand, buddy, I think about, you know, AA putting up atheist billboards that say, you know, it's a myth, you know, on Christmas Day in Times Square, right? I don't think about the guy who's using Socratic questions and encouraging people to think for themselves. You know, I don't know that I see street epistemology as firebrand. I don't know. Anybody else?
I could see why someone would see street epistemology as firebrand, because to some people, questioning this fundamental belief is highly, highly inflammatory. So yes, yeah, you see the firebrand term.
What I believe.
I mean, really, and when back to your question of this idea of, do we need the firebrand and do we need this other character and that other character? I'm again reminded of some of these movements that I deal in regularly. For example, the pro-GMO movement. People ask, do we need this guy making this big deal about how if you're anti-GMO, you're killing people? And then do we need this other guy who's more soft-spoken and just wants to educate people about biotechnology? And I think that the danger in this question is this idea of we. Do we need this? Do we need that? I think in any given movement, whether it's atheism or pro-GMO or pro-vaccine movement, you have to remember that the movement is composed of a lot of different people. And all of these different people have their own goals, right? So just because someone is outspoken in, say, the pro-GMO movement, that doesn't necessarily mean that this one person is super pro Monsanto, whereas another person in this seemingly cohesive pro-GMO movement might be like, screw Monsanto, just for the technology. So again, we need to like kind of remember this mosaic that creates any given movement.
Yeah, I would like to, I guess, get to a better definition of what we mean by firebrand, as Anthony was saying earlier. Do we mean, when we say firebrand, do we mean aggressive in their approach?
No.
Or sure-footed?
Disruptive.
No. I don't think it's any of those. Let me propose this. How about caring enough to do something? That, I think, is I like that definition. And that applies to all the different styles. And what I like about just doing something is that somebody might watch a video of Matt, or somebody might watch a video of Seth or Sarah or Arun Ra or David Silverman or one of the street epistemology videos. And each of those different styles will appeal to different people. And what I like about these firebrand approaches, if you'll allow me to say that, is that people can decide which one fits their personality better. And if they feel more comfortable asking nice, friendly questions and making people feel comfortable, then they might gravitate towards SE. If they really like the counter-apologetic approach and the in-your-face approach, they might try that. Well, but just going out and doing something, saying something, not just letting something slide by, and giving enough, you know, caring enough to actually do something, I think, from my perspective, fits the definition of firebrand.
I don't know if that's enough though, because caring enough to do something, that's quite vague. If I care enough to start a blog, versus I care enough to quit my job and dedicate my whole life to atheist activism, versus I care enough to go to jail over something. I mean, those are all, you're caring enough to do something, but what is
okay,
that?
Okay, strong firebrand, weak firebrand. No, I don't know.
I don't want to get lost in the quicksand of.
I think those are semantics, right? Important ones, no? Because if you mm-hmm. it depends on what that something is and how far one is really willing to go. But I wouldn't call that a firebrand in any case. I think that's an interesting word. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I have a definition for that. So
Matt Dillahunty, come on, tell me what you think.
I don't care. I think Kevin made a great point. Kevin made a great point that I've talked about before when I gave a talk on the myth of the atheist community or an atheist community. There's a broad spectrum of personalities and approaches in there. You can put up clips of me where I'm a firebrand under almost anybody's definition, and you can put up clips of me where I'm a diplomat under almost anybody's definition. So I really don't care that much about what label somebody wants to put on. Any given conversation, I can get emails saying, oh my gosh, you had the patience of a saint and you were really gracious toward that person. And about the same phone call in the same episode, somebody can email and say, oh my gosh, you are the biggest dick I've ever seen.
Yep.
But in that scenario, right? I mean, they're defining firebrand as aggression. And I think that that's wrong. I think this is why this is kind of not a very helpful word, because of the differences in how people perceive it. Because there's a huge difference between being sure-footed and being aggressive. Because you can be, you know, like I consider myself a pretty hardline free speech person, but many people don't perceive me that way. And the reason they don't perceive me that way is that I'm willing to concede good points from the opposition when they have it. And I'm willing to talk about it and discuss it. You know, I'm willing to say, okay, well, I understand that sometimes speech does cause harm, but that doesn't mean I move away from where I am necessarily. So I think that there's a little bit of confusion there of what it means to be a firebrand activist.
Yeah, I think it also just depends on who you're calling out or who you're criticizing in any specific movement. Someone criticizing a leader might be seen as far more inflammatory as someone criticizing some rando on the internet, right? So it all depends kind of on the intent, on the optics, and on so many factors. And so, I think this could be a whole episode.
I think it's a false dichotomy because, first of all, you have a broad spectrum of potential responses, and some of them are going to be slightly more firebrand under different people's definitions. Some are going to be slightly more diplomatic. This is why I just dismissed it, saying I don't care. I think we need as many voices as we can possibly get that are productive. Now, if someone is doing something that is counterproductive to what, you know, I mean, this gets back into the myth of a movement or the movement, but if they're clearly being counterproductive with respect to the goals that we're supposedly sharing, maybe encouraging church-state separation, et cetera, that's a problem. And I don't care if they're doing it nicely or as an asshole. If they are effective, I mean, you know, Hitchens would get in his zone and just snark against religion in ways that almost anybody would view as, oh, that can't possibly be helping. But it was helping. It wasn't always helping. Not everything I'm sure I've done some stuff that's been incredibly counterproductive. But the goal is to move the mission forward to whatever extent we can agree on what the mission should be, which is probably a better question than whether we need firebrands or diplomats. We need people.
Stupid question. What was I thinking? Really? I mean, let me scratch that one off the list here. I'm sorry to have wasted your time.
Can I just add one more thing to that? I won't go firebrand or anything, but if you have the ability to record your interaction, whether you jot it down and make a Facebook post or you're able to record the audio with permission or video with permission, if you can share that, these videos are reaching other people, whether they watch a really aggressive approach or the soft, gentle street epistemology approach. People watch these videos and number one, they get exposed to the different tools that are out there, but they will be affected by that. Many people will watch these videos of the street epistemology stuff and say, I was asking myself the same questions that you were asking her. And the very same expressions that she was giving were the same ones that I was giving. And now I can't believe that anymore. So if I could just put a period on the end of this, like, try to share these exchanges as much as you possibly can, because people are watching.
All right, we've been throwing this term out off and on. Epistemology, street epistemology, of course, epistemology referring to the study of knowledge. Well, after a very short break, I'm going to talk to Anthony Magdabosco about his channel and his methods. Specifically, what is street epistemology and how does it work? That's coming up in just a second. Hang on. Postage rates have gone up again, but with stamps.com, you can keep your rates down with postage discounts of up to 40%. These are discounts that you cannot get at the post office. Stamps.com saves 3 cents on every letter you send. That means you're paying essentially 2016 rates for 2018 stamps. That's awesome. Stamps.com's whole site and software and process is designed to simplify, to save, and to make you as efficient as you can be. Whether it's personal mailings or letters and packages for small business, all of the services of the U.S. Postal Service right there at your fingertips, calculated with your own digital scale using your own computer and printer. And then the mail carrier picks it up. I mean, how easy is that? I have used Stamps.com myself for many years. If you are ready to make postage fast, easy, and easier on your bank account, take advantage of this special offer. It includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. Yours when you go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and then type in my name, Seth Andrews. Log on and start today. Stamps.com. Enter Seth Andrews. My supporters on Patreon get a totally commercial-free version of the weekly podcast and a bonus show just for them. Thank you for being a supporter of me and this broadcast on Patreon. It's huge. It really does matter. And if you are not a patron and would like to be one, just log on to patreon.com/SethAndrews. And thanks so much for the support. Greatly appreciated. And we continue our conversation about tactics, how to change minds, including our own. I was first introduced in Peter Boghossian's book, and you just sort of took it to a whole other level. I'm going to try to describe it. You tell me and everyone else if I did it justice, okay? But you, on your channel, will go out and live broadcast, live stream, random encounters with people that you just meet on the street somewhere. You will ask them if they have a God belief and how sure they are, maybe a scale of 1 to 10. And then you will use the Socratic method to sort of explore how they came to belief, which is what epistemology is, right? The study of knowledge. How do we come to know the things we know? And at the end of your very short encounters, often 5 minutes-ish, 10 minutes or less, you'll ask them, well, now how sure are you? And we'll see that number drop from, hey, I was totally sure at 10 to, oh, now I'm a 6 or a 3 or whatever. Is that a relatively accurate description of what you do and how you do it?
That's pretty good. I don't live stream everything. I don't always ask people to scale their confidence in their belief. Sometimes I just forget. There isn't always movement on the scale. Sometimes a person will say, I'm just as confident. Sometimes I forget to ask the follow-up question after a conversation where a person appeared to drop their confidence, but then they might email me 6 months later and say that they were thinking about it and want to meet again, or maybe they have lowered their confidence. The goal for me, though, personally, is not to see an immediate drop in confidence. I'd be a little worried if people were just dropping their confidence after a five-minute talk. My goal really is to encourage a person to think about the method they use to arrive at that belief. And is it reliable? And I'd be a little worried if somebody just immediately dropped their confidence. I want people to think about this and give it some serious thought.
How do you find these people? Do you just walk up to anybody, anywhere? Do you go to college campuses? Do you go to businesses? Where?
I choose public parks and public schools. However, you don't have to go out in the street and initiate talks to do street epistemology. The irony here is that the most prominent examples of SE are people doing what I do, where they go out and initiate talks in a public area, and they have these pretty good discussions, and people tend to reflect on their beliefs. Most people are using this method will use it over social media or on the phone or when they go to their parents' house for the holidays. The most visible examples are usually with people with cameras on the street, and a very small percentage of the people who are using SE would actually do that. It kind of goes back to the idea of recording it. I want to record these examples so people can see how it's done and possibly consider using that approach with their loved ones, with their friends, with their family.
Anybody else want to talk about the Socratic method and this method in particular?
Anthony and I have talked about this a lot, actually. He's been sat in this room with me having a conversation about it. And I think
don't go to the scale. Please don't go to the scale.
I think what he does is
I'm just kidding.
Because, you know, we need is, like I was saying earlier, we need as many approaches as we can that are, you know, potentially moving the needle depending on what your goal is. There's more than one reason to engage. I like the idea of having an audience because now the things we talked about before, somebody in a relatively safe position can change their mind. I have issues with some of the ways that, Pete and I haven't had a chance to talk about this as much as Anthony and I have, but the Manual for Creating Atheists isn't actually a manual for creating atheists. I think what Anthony's done with street epistemology and encouraging other people to do this is great, but Anthony's goal is not to go out and create atheists. I'm happy to have that as one of many goals, and actually, fundamentally, it's just getting people to care about what's true and trying to get rid of as many, you know, bad, untrue beliefs or unjustified beliefs as possible. I have some concerns about the, you know, the confidence level stuff, because at the end of a conversation, Have you actually lowered someone's confidence level, or have you changed what they're willing to report as their confidence level? And if somebody goes from a 9 to a 7, did they actually go from a 9 to a 7, or were they a 7 at the beginning and they were just, you know, being a bit hyperbolic and, you know, exaggerating? I don't know. But what I do know is I've watched the conversations take place, and whether it's Anthony sitting out there with a camera, you know, getting people at the Alamo, or, you know, our TV show or one-on-one, I've watched those conversations and getting people to think, getting back to the issue that we kind of started with, you know, do you reason your way into it? Are you just kind of running with assumptions, and this stuff has kind of wormed its way into your brain, getting people to think about why they believe what they believe and do they actually care about the truth is incredibly valuable. I mean, it's probably the Socratic method is the best tool we have, because instead, as far as I'm concerned, because instead of me saying, oh, you're wrong, it is a questioning process that gets someone to say, hang on a minute, am I actually right? Do I have good reason to think, you know, this? And it's you're less likely to get defensive walls immediately. If you walk up to somebody and you're wrong, well, first of all, I think you've adopted a burden of proof that you may not be able to meet. Because, like, if theirs is a God belief, they should have the burden of proof. Why on earth would you run into somebody and say, oh, no, there is no God and I can prove it? Because you can't. Yeah, I mean, you're adopting a burden of proof you don't need. But you're also forcing them to put up a wall, because now you're going after something that's key to their identity. And you're not really presenting the sort of thing that's likely to change someone's mind, which is why you end up getting labeled as a firebrand or an asshole or whatever. So I love the Socratic method, and I love what Anthony's been doing with it in street epistemology.
But if somebody says something that's demonstrably wrong, instead of saying that's factually wrong, which is the first instinct many of us have, well, actually, no, this is untrue, and here's the correction, what would be a more effective way in?
I think there are some people who are ready for evidence. They're ready for it. They want to believe true things. They are open to it. But you need to feel people out first. And I think using the Socratic approach to judge, to determine where a person is at, before you waste any time giving them a link to an article or some sort of press release or the latest study that came out, don't waste your time if that won't change their mind. Get some sort of buy-in. Let them actually verbally confirm to you that, yes, if I saw that this wasn't true, then I would look into it further and I might lower my confidence in it. But if they're not evidence-based, then don't waste any time giving people evidence. But if they are, sure, go ahead and share that info.
Sarah, do you want to weigh in?
Yeah. I mean, out of what we've been talking about, I think what Matt said about getting people to care about the truth is more difficult than it sounds. And it's often difficult because it's not necessarily something people will explicitly, I mean, no one goes and says, I don't care about the truth. I mean, I guess occasionally you'll find people.
No, people who watch Alex Jones say they care about the truth.
Everyone says they care about the truth. Everyone will say they care about the truth. But I think that's what makes it a difficult thing to talk about. I think that's what makes that part of the persuasion effort more difficult. And I think that's something that we need to pay more attention to, in the sense that why is it that someone might be, you know, psychologically motivated to not believe in what is true, and what can we do to alleviate those pressures? Because it can be that to believe what is actually the truth will be so devastating to that person, both in the, you know, the consequences for them, for who they are, but also maybe for their family, also maybe for their lifestyle, and we have to be thinking about that when we're discussing this.
Well, let me stay on you, Sarah, and throw this out, because I will hear from time to time someone says, you know, there were just some people out there who just, you know, they need religion to get through, to get by. Mm-hmm. And who are we to take that away from them? They're not as strong as we are. They don't have the tools that we have. Religion is all they've got. So let them have it. What's the harm? Anybody want to speak to that? I'll start with Sarah.
I think I hate that. I hate it when I hear that, because I think it's so condescending, right? It is true, you know, piggybacking on what I was just talking about, that it is true that for some people, leaving religion will have costs that others cannot imagine. But that doesn't mean that it isn't, in the end, something worth pursuing anyway. And it's our job as activists to show them why that is and to help them understand why, despite the difficulty of the process, it's worth getting there in the end.
I also think it's important when we decide to engage with people, whatever tactic we decide to employ, that we have an obligation to be there for them when they start questioning, when they start doubting, whether it's passing them off to recovering from religion or meeting with them again and just having a conversation about how you cope with the difficulties of life and not believing in any God, if they're willing to listen to that. Try to model, try to show them what it's like to live as a non-believer, I think could probably be one of the best things that we can do. But try to be there for them, whether you send them a resource or pass them off to somebody like recovering from religion, try to see it through. You know, when I first started going out, I'd have these great talks, I'd shake their hand and I'd walk away. I didn't even give them a card. And I'm so glad now that I do give people a way to contact me because I get messages all the time, sometimes years later, from people who are now ready to see what life might be like without this belief.
You know, Sarah had said something a minute ago about everybody cares about the truth. And I would love to agree. And I think
that everybody says they care about the truth.
Sure. Except that I've had people on the show, when I press them on this, flatly say that they don't care about the truth.
I've heard that as well.
I'm not necessarily sure what to believe. I think it's a problem of trying to narrow things a bit, because there may be the case that you do care about the truth in categories A, B, C, and D, but not in about the truth in E. And one of the prime examples that we've used to kind of illustrate this point is, you ask people, if you had terminal cancer and you weren't aware of it, would you want to know? Now, that's a question of, would you want to know the truth? And there are people who will say, yes, I definitely would want to know, and people who would say no. And so they're valuing something in this scenario more than the truth, but that doesn't mean they don't care about truth. And, you know, hey, would you care what your actual bank balance is versus your imaginary one? So it may be a case of trying to oversimplify a little bit. I think in general, people care about the truth. And I think almost anybody would say that they care about the truth until you get into, you know, those little side scenarios. But I think all of us at some point, no matter how much we might profess otherwise, don't care about the truth on some subject at some time, because our comfort is, you know, more valuable in that area. And as the guy who put out the t-shirt saying, I want to believe as many true things as few false things, that is my position. That doesn't mean that there's not, you know, somebody could find a subject where maybe I don't want to know the truth as much as I might think I do.
Kevin, did you want to cap this?
Yeah, I think there's a quick point that I'd like to make. And that's that as critical thinkers, we like to define the word truth as the observable truth, the, you know, empirical truth. We see it, it's there, it is true, or we don't see it, it's not there. But you'd be surprised, just in my line of work, how many people I will see define truth in different ways. I mean, there's the observable truth, and then, for example, there's my personal truth. And I'm sure you've all heard that as well. And so when we're talking about truth, I just think it makes sense to define it in the way that we see truth.
It's true for me, right? I mean, this is...
No.
This is
no.
Or I have, you know, there's this idea that I've heard people say something to the effect of, or argue against me. I'll say, okay, there is data, there are oceans of data, there's hundreds, thousands of studies that point to X. And people will say, well, X wasn't true in my life, so my truth goes against the truth of data. And I'm not saying that that's reasonable. I'm saying people most certainly do think that way.
That's on par with confusing weather and climate. That sort of thing. When people say, oh, my truth, or it's true for me, I have the same response. When I use the word truth, I have a specific definition, which is consistent with, you know, epistemology and philosophical foundations, which is truth is that which comports with reality. If you want to talk about truth in some other context, we'll have to use like a substitutionary label. But if there's actual data, the data are what the data are, period. Now, the data could be wrong. You may not be a representative example of that particular data set, but you are an incredibly small sample size. So the fact,
sure.
something hasn't happened for you doesn't change what the truth is. It just changed what your personal experience is.
No, but it was true for me and it was true for my kids. So there you go. You are trying to be reasonable right now, and that's condescending.
There's one question that I found really helpful in breaking through this relativistic approach, this relativistic view of truth, and simply asking a person, do you view truth more as an opinion or a fact? And that's usually a good way of getting a sense of how people are using that word. And sometimes the discovery that, oh, wow, yeah, this, I'm really kind of using it as an opinion. Then they kind of start seeing the nuance there that, 2 + 2 = 4 is not really an opinion, but yet that's really a fact. That is true. And that tends to help a little bit.
Dr. Ryan Cragen is a sociology professor down in Tampa, and he's written several books and he's done some studies, and he has come to the conclusion and produced some data to go along with it that we don't change minds with facts necessarily as much as we change minds by changing people's social circle. So, befriending people, being real around them, developing relationships, just being a human being, being that first before we become these sort of, ambassadors of the evidence of, a superstition-free life of atheism with a capital A, just being real and being likable and being a three-dimensional human is much more effective in changing minds. Anybody want to speak to the relationship factor?
I could speak to that with the context of this recent movie that I'm a part of, a documentary movie called The Science Moms. And it's not just a shameless plug for this movie, but to speak to the point that whether or not there's a good reason for it, people listen to people that they trust. And parents, mothers especially, do not give birth to a PhD when they have a child. But somehow there's this notion that if you have a child, if you have offspring, that you somehow have some sense of credibility, right? And so the trust is so fundamental here that really, whether or not you're a scientist, if you're a mom, especially if you're a celebrity, people listen to you. And so before we even get to these discussions, for better or worse, it really does make sense to form relationships, to find out the common values that you share. And this, I wouldn't necessarily call this a way of promoting rational thinking, but yet if you really want to change minds, then you want to change minds in whatever way you can.
Matt, how is it I usually hear you say it? We'll be at a convention and you'll say you have an order and atheism comes in at number 3 on the list. What is that?
I'm a humanist, I'm a skeptic, and I'm an atheist. And the atheist one is the least important to me, because if the proper application of skepticism were to demonstrate that there was a good reason to believe a God, I would stop being an atheist and would be a theist. But I see no justification by which I could stop being a skeptic. And the same thing kind of holds true to humanist. And flatly, I said, using colorful language on some occasions and not on others, but if there's a God and he's not a humanist, screw him. I don't really care. He needs to need to demonstrate that his particular values were somehow better than humanistic values, and that his methods for discerning right and wrong and correct behavior, etc., were better than humanism. So it's not just merely, oh, now there's a God, I'm going to dump my humanism. I can't. I this is the best method that I know for us to share space, interact, and try to create a better world. So,
do you want to speak to the sort of the likability factor, the relationship factor of changing the social circle question?
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand exactly.
Here's a great example is that I have some dear friends that we play tennis with, and I had known them and we'd played tennis and we only saw each other really on the tennis court and became buddies. And they saw me as a guy that was fun and we'd like to play tennis and we laugh, we'd go out for dinner afterwards. And it was only after we developed a personal relationship that they found out that I, hosted
the Thinking Atheist radio podcast and website. And of course, you know, you could see them blanch a little bit because they're both religious. Had they known I was an atheist at the beginning before we developed a relationship, there's a good chance that I would have gotten no traction with them. But since they'd already seen me as a flesh and blood human being that they liked, it was a whole lot harder to put me in a box.
Yeah, it's getting rarer for me to meet somebody who doesn't have any familiarity with what I do, just because it occupies so much of my life that I tend to only meet people through that. But I have friends that I couldn't tell you at all what they believe about, you know, gods or science or anything. I mean, we just don't interact on that level. We might, you know, we might be friends in the magic community or friends in a gaming community, and we just interact on that level and never go beyond it. But for the people who have gotten to know me without knowing the atheist, the skeptic, the humanist part of it, I think it certainly changed how we interacted, because people who, let's say, have been fed information about who atheists are, what the secular community is about, and they've been fed misinformation, all that baggage is there in their head. And if the first thing out of your mouth is, "Hi, I'm Matt, I'm an atheist," all you're doing is flipping the switch for all that baggage to come on. That doesn't mean that I'm advocating for hiding it at all. Anybody asks me what I believe, I'm happy to let them know. On the other hand, there are people in my neighborhood. They don't know who I am. They don't know what I believe, but they know me as a decent neighbor who's going to participate in this, or who keeps his yard nice, or whatever the case may be. As soon as you get to know somebody and you're friends with them, and then you find out that they're in a category that you would consider suspect. I'm a liberal, I'm a conservative, whatever the label is. If it would have set them off beforehand, now they have to reconcile that with the image they've already developed of you. So if you know people who are gay, it's a lot harder to hate gay people. If you know people who are Muslims or ex-Muslims or atheists or anything, you pick a category. If you get to know them as people first, and they are decent people, it's much, much harder to vilify them. It's much easier to keep up these barriers as long as you're not actually interacting with people outside of your little pocket of reality.
Having relationships with people who hold an opposing point of view, I mean, this just isn't done these days, right? We're all guilty by association. If you're seen in the zip code of any specific person, there's a guilt by association narrative out there so often. Sarah Hayter, did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I just the other day there was a Pew poll that came out. I mean, maybe a week ago, about people who leave Islam, and it said that, you know, 23%, something like that, about a quarter of people who are raised Muslim in America no longer identify with the religion. Some of them become Christian. Many of them become atheists or agnostics, or say that they have no religion altogether. I found this number to be crazy high, right? I mean, I work with ex-Muslims, so I know that there are more of us than people know, but I didn't know that it was a quarter of all the people that were raised Muslim. That seemed unbelievable to me. But when you think about the social environment that people who are raised Muslim grow up in, and the way that they are, you know, the way that they form relationships, and the way that they're encouraged to not leave their little bubble. And I think maybe the most potent of all of that is the way that they are taught to look at people who no longer believe in Islam or who've never believed, right? There's a sense of those people they're XYZ, they're terrible, they're immoral, they're whatever it is. And even if you are actually maybe an atheist, or actually you don't really believe, you don't want to apply the label to yourself because it has been so effectively demonized by your community, and you come to believe it yourself. You come to absorb some of those feelings without really knowing what exactly is going on. So I think it's really interesting to consider the different ways that our social environments affect the way that we treat other people. I will say that I think atheists are not immune to this kind of thinking. And I've seen this very often in atheist communities, not necessarily in the ways that we're willing to relate and be friends with people who are non-theists, but in the ways that we communicate with and the ways that we judge people who might have different political affiliations than us. And I've seen this time and time again, and I find it to be so destructive. So, you know, dogma comes in many forms, and social bubbles come in many forms too.
That's what I really like about your approach, Anthony, is that, you know, you have a way about you that is endearing. It's non-threatening. You just seem like you care. And I know that other people see that in motion. You know, you have a way of approaching people without putting them on the defensive. And that's not something I see, you know, enough of.
Yeah, I think people were really taken aback by when the street epistemology videos started coming out, not just mine, but other people that were uploading them, is the, Matt had mentioned earlier, this sort of creating this sort of sense of safety. Here, we can talk here. It's okay to tell me what you believe, why, and how you're so sure. And if you can create an environment where somebody feels comfortable disclosing their methodology and possibly disclosing the doubts that they have, I think that could be really beneficial in helping a person truly reflect on their belief. And sort of just to pivot just quickly back to the social circle idea, that this is the one area where I think atheists don't give enough thought to. Because when you're talking to a believer and they're presented with this idea that they're believing something that might not be true, it's more than just the belief that they might lose. They might lose that relationship with their spouse. They might lose a job, even possibly. They're definitely going to lose some friends. And it could be really hard. They will start asking, you know, what else will I lose if I discard this belief? So, yeah, these are really challenging things that people who hold these beliefs have to go through. And I think if you could approach it very friendly from the start and try to approach it as a partnership to work with them through this, how can we get through it? And let me show you, I don't believe in any gods and I'm able to cope through these things. Or maybe you know somebody who doesn't believe, which I think goes to, we should try to be out if we can, because that just normalizes it. And it shows that, hey, you know, that guy down the street really isn't such a bad guy.
That leads into my second to last question. But first, real quick, Matt, did you want to weigh in on the social bubble thing?
Yeah. So I've been complaining a lot about how it seems everybody, even right down to the way Facebook works and constantly puts you in touch with the people who agree with you, you know, so you end up seeing less and less, and, you know, MSNBC may be as bad as Fox News and all this other stuff. But I wanted to point out that I'm happy to block people. I block people on Facebook. I block people on Twitter. And there are people who look at that and say, oh, you're just trying to create an insular bubble. And that may be the case sometimes for some people. But for me, it's more a matter of how I need to manage my time. I will engage with, I have friends who disagree with me on all kinds of things. And I am out publicly debating anything and everything, ethical veganism and whatever, pick something. I love to have those engagements. But my Facebook page, I don't want to be barraged by everybody who wants to take a shot at me, or I need to debate Matt on subject X. And so when it becomes clear that there's somebody who isn't interested in an actual productive conversation, I have no problem at all blocking them on Facebook. And yet that exact same person, I would happily sit down and have a conversation with somewhere else when it's appropriate. So I'm not creating an insular bubble for the sake of avoiding those things. I'm doing it so that I can focus on what I need to focus on at the right
times. You guys have been very generous with your time. Let me toss this out, which ties into what Anthony had just said. We're often asking people not just to reevaluate and leave a bad idea, religion, but in doing so, they're going to leave their social structure, the church service where everybody knows their name and their kids go to have activities and vacation Bible school and Tuesday night Bible study and fellowships, and everybody they know is a believer. They risk losing so much. We frame many times losing our faith, and I've been guilty of doing this. Can we talk about it in terms of what people gain, right? If I walk away from religion, do we as a movement have to do a better job of creating a place, a soft place for them to land, right? What are we offering if we're asking people to give up so much? Anybody?
I think this has been the focus of what I've seen a lot of smaller communities and eventually the bigger communities doing in recent years. We are getting better. We are definitely behind the curve with regard to creating landing places. it kind of came to my mind that there were teenagers who were kicked out of their house, and we had to help them find a new place to live because they no longer believed, and their parents couldn't cope with that. So you just don't get to live here anymore. But as you're pointing out, it's broader than that. If you lose your entire social network just because you no longer believe or you can't participate in this, then there needs to be some organization. There's actually a bunch of them now. You got Sunday Assembly, you got Oasis, you have Atheist Community of X and the Ethical Society and all these places. It's just, from the standpoint in the United States, religions have an incredibly unfair advantage in the sense that not only they have this tax exempt status forever, but they've had this kind of status quo forever of, oh, well, of course, church is a good thing. And hey, what church do you go to? And you just moved to town. Would you like to come to our church? Hey, we'll help you move in. We'll help you move furniture. We'll make you some food until you get your, you know, refrigerator stocked and stuff like that. I think waking people up to the good things that are done by religious people, perhaps on behalf of their religion. I don't think those are good things from religion. I think those are good things from good people. It's just that they've built a mechanism by which they can encourage people to donate, to participate, to help out. I'd like to see the same thing happening, and I think it is happening, in the secular community without the kind of guilt motivation or the, oh, you need to do this because God said so. No, you need to do this because this is who we are as human beings. Let's help each other out a little bit. You might need help. How difficult it is. We've talked about altruism for ages. You know, is there such a thing? And is there anything truly altruistic? I think you can have a purely selfish foundation for altruism just by recognizing that I have to share space with other people so that the good things I do that propagate out may benefit me as well. Whether or not that counts as true altruism, I really don't care, because what it does is it addresses the truth about how we're going to have to interact as human beings, that by and large, we're social creatures, that my beliefs inform my actions have consequences, not just for me, but for the people around me. And the same is true for them, which is why I care about what people believe.
Sarah, I know you see this with ex-Muslims of North America and beyond, right? They're essentially, many of them, working now without a net. So you are helping to create sort of a place for them to land, right?
Yeah. So we build communities of ex-Muslims across the United States and Canada. So I understand. I mean, that's how we began, was just as a community building organization. And now we're doing some more, you know, outspoken, like, advocacy work and education based projects just to educate the public. But we started in the heart of our organization has been the communities. And it's hard to overstate the importance of having that, just that one or two or three people that you know who are like you, who think like you, in giving people the confidence to actually voice their opinions in their broader circles, in their communities, in their on their families, because they know that they won't be totally alone. And I think it's just easy to forget how human we are, and it's easy to forget how much we need this and how much we rely on it, whether or not we articulate it out loud. But what ex-Muslims in North America wants to do is to build local communities for ex-Muslims, so there is somebody that they know. And if they need help, if they need a couch to sleep on, we can connect them with people who are like-minded, and we can connect them with people who understand. And I think, you know, it's one of those things, like, the hope is that we won't need to exist. The hope is that we won't need to build these specific communities for ex-Muslims. So I'm working to try and change the you know, dialogue within Muslim communities enough that we won't need to exist and there won't need to be this organization.
So I've been volunteering for Recovering From Religion for the last 3 years, the first two of which I was a hotline operator. I wanted to see what's the flip side of an SE conversation or somebody that's experiencing doubt. And I can't tell you how many times that I would take a call and somebody say, I'm an atheist, I don't believe in any gods, but there's just nobody in my community. And then we do a quick search and find out that there's a group that meets every Tuesday just down the street from where they live. So regarding this whole idea of what do I do when I don't believe this anymore? Where do I go? More than likely, there's a community just waiting for you. They've gone through this before. They are there to catch you if you need it. You just need to look. And if there isn't anything in your area, consider starting it, because more than likely there are other people just down the street from you who also don't believe that are looking for something. So sometimes we have to create our own landing spots. We have to create our own communities. And if they're not there, and it's definitely worth the time and effort if you find yourself having to do that.
I'd say that to students who say, you know, I'm looking for a secular student alliance in my high school or university. And if one doesn't exist, I'm like, start one, right? Because they've got kits available. You can be the first so that the next person who is asking might be able to find you. Kevin, did you want to weigh in real fast?
Well, yeah, just to everyone else's points, we're talking about shifting from one community to another. From my own experience, not in converting people away from religion, but just convincing people to take more science-based views. There's this one extreme that's absolutely real and horrifying of people getting kicked out of their house for coming out as atheists, and that's awful, and there should absolutely be couches and open-minded people for them. And then there's the other, maybe seemingly less daunting concern of, say, being kicked out of a local crunchy group if you live in a certain part of California, right? And that can seem as daunting to a certain type of person. And so the reality is, I've stood there with open arms, or people like me have stood there with open arms trying to convince people to come on, come to the other side. The water's fine. But you can stand there for 2 years, and it's on the, you know, 2 years and 1 month mark that the person can finally come over. So I think it's also just about being accessible and being accessible no matter how long it takes and how much work it takes.
If I may, you know, I don't want to have a show about tactics without trying to give some resources and tools and sort of an exclamation point to those who are wanting to do this better. They want to have conversations and be more effective. They do want to help change minds, even their own, when they're wrong. So can each of you just kind of weigh in real fast? I mean, how do we change minds? How do we change the world? Forgive the broad question, but what resources do you like? What tactics do you find most effective? What do you think? I'll start with you, Sarah Hayter. What's your perspective?
I do see one, this one behavior that's becoming more common, it seems like, which is not just cutting people off whenever I have whatever calculation for when a person is somebody I don't want to talk to, and then I choose to cut them off. But there's something that people do where they also cut off other people who don't share their line exactly as they see it. So they say, well, I would have stopped talking to this person at this point, but you have not. And because you have not stopped talking to this person, you are no longer welcome in my community. You are not welcome in my social circle. And I think this is so incredibly toxic. And I see this everywhere. I see this on the right. I see this on the left. And I see this as something that is just making polarization, political polarization specifically, but ideological polarization in general, worse. And it's becoming a bigger problem because of it. So if there's one, thing that I can point to as what not to do, is it's not necessarily to, you know, draw the line yourself wherever you want it, but not to police others on where they should be drawing the line.
Interesting too. How are we supposed to go out there and effectively engage minds and engage believers, religious believers, if we can't effectively engage each other? We can't have conversations with those we disagree with who are atheists or liberals or whatever label you want to embrace. You know, everybody has to be Hitler. Everybody has to be the villain. They have to be the worst of the worst.
Yeah, I'd never block Sarah for not blocking somebody that I blocked. That's just
unacceptable.
Well, I think Matt blocked me because I didn't call him Mr. Dillahunty, but that's another conversation.
So. I'll probably get blocked for calling him Mr. Dillahunty.
Yes, I will block you if you do that again. One of the funny things is I host the Atheist Experience. My Patreon thing is Atheist Debates. And so the A word is tied to me. And like I talked about earlier, it's number three on that list of what's potentially important. But when people ask me for recommendations, what book should I read or what resource should I have, you know, if I have a similar goal to you? The first book I always recommend is Innumeracy by John Allen Paulos, which talks about how bad we are at math and statistics. And it's eye-opening about the sort of assumptions we make and the errors in reasoning we make. It's a really good, like, starter book on how to change the way you think. And, you know, then there's infidels.org and Talk Origins if you want to get into specifics on arguments. But the best thing you can do is be yourself, be out if it's possible, if you're, you know, in a position where you can do that. But talk to people, ask them what they believe and why. And the why is the important part. The what they believe is slightly less important than the why, because if the why is broken, it can potentially affect a whole bunch of what's. So that would be the thing to try and focus on. And if their why is better than your why, then you should change your mind, because you're probably wrong.
And one thing you say often too, Matt, is that, you know, we need to get over our fear of saying, I don't know. Like, if, you know, instead of feeling like it's a weakness, to be able to just honestly say, you know what, I don't have the answer, but let's go find out, right?
Yeah. And I wish I had more time and more knowledge to focus on, like, public education, because I think one of the greatest disservices we're doing, in addition to not teaching critical thinking early enough, is everybody I've ever met has been sat in a classroom terrified that somebody's going to ask them to come up to the blackboard or ask them a question they don't know. And so we instill a fear of saying, I don't know. And instead, we should be applauding somebody who says, I don't know, because not only is it accurate if you are uninformed on a particular topic, but it may be the right answer. Maybe none of us know, or maybe you've asked a question and you say, I don't know the answer. Then let's go find out. That's, you can't fix ignorance if you make people afraid to ask questions and to acknowledge that they don't have the answer to everything. And when you look at religions, it's one of the biggest objections I've had is that religions seem to pretend that they have the answers to everything, including things that we don't seem to have any answers for.
A biogenesis, right? Where did the first cell come from? Those types of things.
Something rather than nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. And neither do you. Coven Synapathy, you have any final thoughts for us?
Refrain from assuming that someone that holds kind of a non-evidence-based view is anti-data or anti-science. It might just be, as we touched on earlier, that their value system or their community has shaped up in a way that they have a really good reason to not change their belief. And a final actionable tip that I learned recently and came as a surprise to some of my friends, at least, is that you can mute specific conversations on Twitter without muting specific accounts. So just click on the little triangle on the right and hit mute this conversation, and then you will not get notifications for the rest of that thread. There you go. You're welcome.
Because life is too short, right? Yeah, it's an interesting point too, before I get to Anthony, but, you know, it's, let's make sure we're both talking about the same thing. You know, if someone says something to me, there's merit in me actually restating their position back to them to make sure that I'm on their page and not addressing an argument they never made, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think we end up talking past each other far more often than not when it comes to these issues.
Anthony Magnabosco, any final thoughts, my friend?
Yeah, I think so. So regarding the actionable tasks, I kind of boiled it down to three things here. I just jotted down some notes. Assess your own skills. What am I good at? Am I good at arguing with people? Am I good at listening? Am I good at both of those things? And then also assess your goals. Am I looking to impart doubt? Am I looking to have a cordial conversation with somebody where they might say, I don't know? Am I looking to completely disabuse a person of their belief? And then finally, look at all the different tools that are out there. There are so many different approaches. Find the one that best fits your style and become really, really good at it and just do something.
Are we there? Like, how are we approaching this? Are we approaching this necessarily as I'm here to sway others? Because that's not how I approach it. And that's not how I think we should approach it. I think we should view it as okay, we're both going, there's a quest for truth, and I'm, you know, a traveler there. I'm trying to get to the truth, whatever it is, because when we look at it as certainly we're here to convince others, we're assuming that we have found the truth. Like we ourselves, we our side is correct. And I think that's just in application, that doesn't make much of a difference, that viewpoint shift, but I think it does help center your own perspective on things in a way that's more helpful, because it may turn out to be that we are in the end not correct.
I think that's a great way to keep people off the defensive, and I'll say this as well. I think we just want to find out what's true. When people ask me why I'm an atheist or why I reject the idea of gods, I'll often say, I just want to, whatever's true, let's do that. And if the idea of God shows up tomorrow, well, I'd want to know that, and let's pursue that, and let's weigh the evidence about that. And if that God is proven, absolutely, I'll go back and change the website, the Thinking Theist, and we'll put a cross in there somewhere. I mean, I don't know, but I mean, to be able to tell people my end zone is not, I want to make everybody an atheist. I think let's all pursue truth. And I honestly think that if we're pursuing the evidence and we're using rationality and reason and skepticism, that we'll end up as non-believers in the supernatural, as hopefully humanists at the end anyway. But I think that does have merit. The atheism isn't my end goal. Let's just live truthful lives, right?
I think I agree with that. Atheism is not my end goal either. My end goal is to help people hone, including myself, help us hone the best tools we can to get to the truth. This is what street epistemology has become to me. Is it's more, how do we figure out the best tools to determine what's true? And yes, I think atheism is a potential result of that journey, but it's, in my view, it's not the goal, at least not for me personally.
I want to thank the entire panel for a terrific conversation, for your perspective. We're just sort of chatting here, people who've done a lot of this, talking about their own experiences. I would encourage you to follow each individual channel and website and link and podcast and whatever. I will include all those links in the description box, but it's well worth your time to incorporate their work into your lives. I've learned a lot. I know you will as well, and you'll find yourself really encouraged by what you see and hear. So to all of you, thank you for your time and your perspective.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Seth.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.